live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, a special guest, a professor emeritus, talking about one of the least known false flag operations in U.S. history, the attack on the American spy ship, the USS Liberty, in 1967. My guest will be Professor Joan Mellon. This will be a very interesting conversation. Also, we will be having part two of the politics of science, the corruption of science, and how that impacts the medicines we receive and the treatment we also get on a daily basis. But we're beginning with the latest on health and healing. From the University of Montreal, new data showing that there is a heightened risk of birth defects with antidepressants. And this is important. This was published in the British Medical Journal. It reveals that antidepressants, which are so widely prescribed, not just for women, but pregnant women in particular, could increase the chance of having a baby with birth defects. And it's a high risk, up to 10%. So, once again, we should ask ourselves, if a woman is pregnant, are there other forms of therapy to help her with whatever is depressing her? And the answer is yes. And there are a lot of good humanistic approaches using psychology and behavioralism. We should not be putting that mother and child at risk. And we are. So it's just a heads up. Next up, we now have in-depth knowledge that a lack of physical activity causes teenagers' bones to become weak and fragile. This is according to the University of British Columbia study. And parents, please pay attention. Less active teenagers have been shown to have weak, fragile bones. And this is important because if as a teenager they have weak and fragile bones, a lot of their immune system is created like the B cells in the bone marrow. Also, it means as they start to gain weight as adults, that's more pressure upon the bones. And that means that their bones strength is critical for preventing fractures, so they're going to end up with a lot of fractures. Quote, kids who are sitting around are not loading their bones in ways that promote bone strength, according to the study. So we need more physical activity, more exercise, more. The human skeleton needs to be exercised on a daily basis. And that's it. So let's get all people, and if you want to be a good example, exercise with your teen, biking and powerlifting, resistance exercises, versa climbing, they're all good. And this was published in the International Osteoporosis Foundation Journal, and it was also done through the National Institutes of Health. Also, this shouldn't surprise us. This is a University of Montreal study, and it showed that prolonged exposure to work-related stress can create some certain cancers in the body. And for men, prolonged exposure to work-related stress has been linked to an increased likelihood of lung, colon, rectal, and stomach cancer and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. The findings are among the results obtained by researchers at the University of Montreal, who conducted the first study to assess the link between cancer and work-related stress, and this was published in Preventive Medicine. We have to understand that the most stressful jobs, like firefighters, industrial engineering, aerospace engineering, a mechanic foreman, vehicle and railway, equipment repair workers, these are just some, and it puts a lot of stress on them. And for the same individual, stress varied depending upon the job held, but they all end up causing an impact upon the immune system. And I'll explain why. When you're under stress, the body responds immediately. It produces stress hormones, cortisol being the leading one. Unfortunately, where these are supposed to help you for about a minute to 2 minutes, they can be on all day until you go to sleep at night and you wake up stressed. And as a result of that, it virtually overstimulates your immune system and causes autoimmune disorders, and it can also cause massive inflammation of the organs, including the brain. And that's how cancer gets started, with the inflammatory process. From the University of California at Irvine, fasting can help to improve overall health. Another in the ever-accumulating evidence that periodic fasting, taking one day a week and just having liquids throughout the day. You can have liquid protein shakes. You can have green vegetable juices and red vegetable juices. You can spike it with some fiber and vitamins. But that is important. Fasting affects the circadian clocks in the liver and the skeletal muscles, causing them to rewire their metabolism, which can lead to improved health and protection against aging and diseases of aging that they tell us. Though my position is that dementia and Alzheimer's are not normal to the process of aging. They are normal to the process of unhealthy aging and unhealthy lifestyle. This was published in Cell Report. The takeaway message: let's begin to fast on a periodic basis, and simply taking longer period of time between a meal. For example, if you have a meal at, let's say, 7 o'clock in the morning, and you don't eat again until later in the day, that is also considered a part of fasting. And then when you're not eating at night, let's say after 7 o'clock, and you don't eat till 7 in the morning, that 12 hours that you're not eating, that slows down the aging process. Also, from Aston University, which is in the United Kingdom, the dangers of formaldehyde exposure are linked to dementia, diabetes, and depression. So for many adults, the word formaldehyde may sum up memories of a long-ago biology class, and the smelly fluid used to preserve the frogs intended for dissection. But this toxic chemical found in a wide range of everyday products is actually closer at hand than you might think, and it is very dangerous. A new scientific review explores a potential link between formaldehyde exposure, and by the way, they use formaldehyde in carpets to preserve them. They use it in clothing to preserve them. In fact, one of the first jobs I had in New York City was at a men's haberdasher clothing store down on 74th and Broadway. The owner was a very nice guy, and I was there helping him in his store. And every day my eyes would water, my nose would run, and after a couple of weeks I said, I can't work here. There's something in here. So, oh, it's just the formaldehyde. They put it in the suits to keep the moths from eating them and allow them to last longer. Well, I didn't know that at the time. Now we know that formaldehyde can increase your risk of depression, dementia, and diabetes. So, and formaldehyde destroys cells by cross-linking proteins. So the major exposed route for formaldehyde is inhaling it from indoor sources. And when you consider that formaldehyde is a common constituent of carpeting, paper products, plywood, cleaning products, glues, insecticides, cigarette smoke, and even wrinkle-resistant fabrics, all of those could contain formaldehyde. And it causes this harmful cross-linking of the body's proteins, the same process that occurs when you have a lot of sugar, which I discussed yesterday. Remember I talked about glycation, or the cross-linking from high blood sugar items, and that can damage cells and cause portions of the body's tissue to become non-functional. So, incidentally, formaldehyde is officially classified by the International Agency for Research on cancer is a carcinogen. People think formaldehyde is just what they put in embalming fluid. No, it's used in a lot of different ways. And also, it's used in vaccine production. So that shouldn't be allowed. And also today, they did a meta-analysis, meaning multiple studies. This was at the Shijing University in China. And they found that supplementing with sea buckthorn, that's sea, S-E-A, as in the ocean, buckthorn, B-U-C-K-T-H-O-R-N, could significantly reduce heart disease risk by improving blood cholesterol and blood lipid profiles. And there were a lot of studies showing that 11 independent randomized controlled trials determined that there was a definite link between sea buckthorn intake and changes in blood lipid profiles. And this was published in Trends in Food Science and Technology. So for people who have a problem with cholesterol, sea buckthorn, non-toxic and natural. Also, there was a protein isolated from baker's yeast that shows potential against leukemia cells. This was done at the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil and published in the Journal of Scientific Reports. So an enzyme identified in the commonly known brewer's yeast or baker's yeast has passed in vitro trials demonstrating its capacity to kill acute lymphoblastic leukemia cells. Mind you, this is natural and non-toxic. So any kind of natural chemotherapy, something that's extracted from a natural substance that has no toxic reactions, that's good news for all the people suffering from leukemia that might otherwise not have that. And finally, from Sun Yat-sen University in Taiwan, comes a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. That's the gold standard, showing that berries are good for your heart and impact on platelets. And when you consider that the number one medical cause of death is heart attacks and strokes, and you think that something as simple, inexpensive, and easy to consume, and delicious as berries, and that protects you, the potential cardiovascular benefits of the antho, A-N-T-H-O, cyanidins, C-Y-A-N-I-N-S, can be associated with their ability to influence the expression of chemicals by platelets in the blood. And that's this new randomized double-blind controlled study, and it was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrition and Metabolism. And it wasn't a lot. It was just 320 milligrams per day of a purified anthocyanidin, equivalent to about 100 grams or 3 ounces, 3 ounces, it's not even a cup, of blueberries or blackberries. And this went on for 24 weeks. So, good news, a healthier heart, better blood, less likelihood of blood clumping, berries each day. And hopefully you're getting yours. We're going to take a break and come back. Now, normally we would now go to your questions, but I don't know how long my commentary is going to run on part two today of our going into depth on the corruption of science and the collapse of modern civilization. Richard Gale and myself wrote this. It is published in its entirety, all footnoted, so it can be used in a form. You could use it to give to your doctor. You could use it to show what has happened to our healthcare system. It's up on prn.fm, PRN, Progressive Radio Network.fm. And when I just Googled it this morning, I wanted to see how we were doing, because I'm on the road and I'm not in the office where all of our IT people are. Looking over all this, we had 45 million search results this morning just on Progressive Radio Network. So it's interesting to see people are interested and are coming over, and we're glad to hear that. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is part two of our special Corruption of Science article. Ronald Reagan was the first deregulator-in-chief, opened a pathway for private interests to gain greater control over the sciences. And according to Leslie Janka, a former White House deputy press secretary under Reagan, his entire presidency was public relations. Quote, this was a PR outfit that became president and took over the country, and to the degree then which the Constitution forced them to do things like make a budget, run a foreign policy, and all that, they sort of did it. But their first, last, and overarching activity was public relations, end quote. Reagan, who consulted astrologers for decision-making, was a scientific illiterate who favored private economic growth over altruism and consumer safety. This meant gutting the Environmental Protection Agency, stripping it of its ability to combat industry's propensity to evade regulatory hurdles and pollute the environment. It was also during the Reagan era that pharmaceutical firms infiltrated the halls of the federal government. Through concerted lobbying and persuasion, Ronald Reagan signed the 1986 National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act to protect vaccine makers from financial liability due to vaccines' adverse effects. Now, before this bill, only a few firms continued to manufacture vaccines. The financial risks and compensation burden from vaccine injuries were too high for most drug companies. Reagan is therefore credited for launching the current vaccine boom, estimated to be worth about $60 billion a year, and that'll hit that mark next year, with no legal liability placed upon companies for pushing unsafe and minimally effective vaccines. This trend entered hyperdrive under President Clinton, who perceived himself as the first biotech president and invited more corporate executives with conflicts of interest into his administration than any previous president in American history. If the proliferation of GMOs, genetically modified organisms, is regarded as a contagion and a curse on human and environmental health, then Clinton, Bill, and Hillary, as they were co-presidents, is ultimately to be blamed. There are three primary avenues by which science became corrupted and thereby damages the public health and the environment. These include, one, corporate influence over scientific discoveries that are developed into products for public consumption. Two, corruption within scientific community itself. Three, the emergence of a positive philosophy towards science that displays to all of the dogmatic trimmings of fundamentalist religious faith and seeks full protection from government to become the reigning ideology of the state. Now, this latter trend has been termed scientism, an incoherent ideology that identifies rationality and reason with science itself. Scientism embraces the premise that science can explain everything. One of the more common criticisms against scientism is its claims that science has already resolved questions that are inherently beyond its ability to answer. This scientific hubris particularly plagues the biological disciplines such as mental health, immunology, drug-based conventional medical therapies, and also neurobiology, the genetic etiology of disease, nanomedicine, and genetic modification of plants for industrial agriculture. One unrecognized consequence of scientism is that it plays directly into corporate hands to advance its financial interest and commercial control over a population. by tossing aside philosophical and ethical considerations over natural scientific discoveries and findings, scientific truths stand alone as sterile and amoral tools that can be used as economic weapons of destruction. This is most evident in the pharmaceutical industry that pushes questionably effective and unsafe drugs to treat physical and mental disorders, or the agrochemical corporations poisoning the public with carcinogenic pesticides and environmentally damaging genetically modified crops. According to a report released by the Union of Concerned Scientists, quote, corporations attempt to exert influence at every step of the scientific and policy-making process, often to shape decisions in their favor or avoid regulation and monitoring of their products and byproducts at the public expense, end quote. In order to achieve their goals, private interests make every attempt to win over the White House, congressional leaders, senior federal agency officials, and even the judicial courts. One of science-generated industry's greatest threats is independent evaluation of the scientific research supporting their products. Winning over or buying the allegiance of the heads of congressional committees and the executive tiers of federal agency regulators is therefore a high priority in order to ensure the gears of bureaucracy remain oiled, the licensing channels for product approval stay wide open, and the regulatory due diligence and scientific scrutiny don't intrude on profits. There are several ways that private corporations succeed in influencing the government to do their bidding, ensuring the judicial terrain is safe for corporations to penetrate scientific malfeasance and fraud. This includes manipulating and fudging scientific data, preserving and exerting control over scientists, taking control of peer-reviewed scientific literature. Although these tactics are found in many industries, it is the medical and food sectors that are today the most corrupt, acting with blatant criminality. Charles Seif and his students at New York University sought to determine to what extent the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, covers up evidence of fraud and corruption in medical drug trials. They reviewed FDA documents for about 600 different clinical trials. How often do federal health officials discover flagrant and intentional misconduct and subsequently decide to bury the evidence of out of sight of the medical community? Seif discovered such actions were an official pattern within the agency, given the high rate of content-related or blacked out from the documents the FDA provided, the investigators could only determine which pharmaceutical company or drug was involved in one of six of the review trials. For one trial alone, where FDA inspectors found significant fraud and significant misconduct, 78 different medical publications printed articles based upon that single flawed study. Let me repeat that. FDA inspectors found inside their own agency massive fraud, massive misconduct, and still 78 different medical publications printed articles based upon that single study. In an article for Slate, the professor writes, quote, "Nobody ever finds out which data is bogus, which experiments are tainted, and which drugs might be on the market under false pretenses. The Food and Drug Administration has repeatedly hidden evidence of scientific fraud, not just from the public, but also from its most trusted scientific advisors, even as they were deciding whether or not a new drug should be allowed on the market. Even a congressional panel investigating a case of fraud regarding a dangerous drug could not get forthright answers, end quote. In one case, a new anti-blood clotting drug was tested in four large trials, which recruited thousands of patients and clinical sites in over a dozen countries. According to the professor, one of the trials, quote, was a fiasco. In half of the 16 clinical sites, the FDA discovered, quote, misconduct, fraud, fishy behavior, or other practices so objectionable that the data had to be thrown out, end quote. One Colorado site falsified data. In the Mexican site, there was, quote, systematic disregard of medical records, end quote. Now, despite these overwhelming problems, the drug trial was published favorably in the prestigious British journal, The Lancet. The Food and Drug Administration found similar problems in three other trials. In one of the data was ruled, quote, worthless. That's worthless by the FDA's own inspectors. The FDA Advisory Committee of Expert Reviewers were only informed that the inspectors discovered, quote, significant issues at two sites in one of the trials for the drug, but that drug, nevertheless, was approved in 2011, and since then, lawsuits for wrongful deaths from that single drug have piled up. Now, has anyone at the FDA been held accountable for covering up this information? No. How about all the scientists who sit on these FDA and CDC advisory panels that decide which drugs should go forward and if there's adequate data to provide safety and efficacy? And they were wrong and they had information showing that this was a bad drug. Were any of these individuals held accountable? Reprimanded? No. Was anybody anywhere held accountable? No. So just more deaths and injuries, and the company would pay a fine and go back to business as usual, and the fine was not a problem because it's included as part of the cost of doing business. In another case in 2010, Cedaro, a private research company that contracts with Big Pharma, falsified data for over 1,400 drug safety and efficacy trials conducted for roughly 100 drugs, mostly generic knockoffs, that were being considered for the U.S. market. Now, although the FDA uncovered this fraud, it has refused to make these 100 drugs known to the profession, and as a result, medical doctors and the public do not know if they're taking those fraudulently done drugs. The FDA was not there to protect the public. A possible reason some federal health agencies have been squeezed into an administrative straitjacket, pulled over tighter by industry, is the excessive downsizing and withdrawal of funds during the current and past two presidencies. A decade ago, Jessica Washburn reported on the dire situation at the National Institutes of Health Center for the Evaluation of Risks to Human Reproduction, and this is for Discovery Magazine. The center is responsible for the evaluation of chemicals and their impact on reproductive health. With continued deregulation following the Koch brothers' agenda to permit private industries to flood the environment with toxic substances, this is an enormously important department tasked with assuring the health of pregnant women and protecting their fetuses. Yet the center only employed three people, one of whom was part-time. That means you got two people. The vast majority of the workload was outsourced to a private consulting firm, Sciences International. For almost 10 years, this firm, which had been receiving funding from over 40 chemical companies, was the primary evaluator of the environmental toxins mother-to-bees were being exposed to. I'm going to do one more section for today, and then we'll continue with part three on our next program. Now we're going to look at publication prejudice, fraud, and deceptive favoritism. During the past decade, scientific prejudice and bias and outright deceit have been endemic to peer-reviewed scientific literature, especially in the medical and psychiatric fields. Medical journals have been thoroughly hijacked by the pharmaceutical industry, as have university departments and research institutions that are principally funded by private interest. It is no longer a secret that industry-funded studies inordinately convey positive results. Positive research is published, negative research is suppressed and buried. Let me give you an example. Let's say that a pharmaceutical company wants to bring out a new drug, and they test it 100 times in different cities, different universities, and 99 of those studies not only show that the drug is not good, but it's dangerous, it's toxic. But there's one study at one center that is relatively neutral. Suddenly, you will see 99 studies never seeing the light of day. They never have to be reported on. They never have to be shown. No one will ever know they existed. And that one marginal study will suddenly make it as if it's a new breakthrough drug. The public relations teams will hire ghostwriters, famous people who will get a lot of money in order to put their name on an article, and then that article with all these famous people get published in a major journal, which just so happens they're going to be taking out 30 pages of advertising over the next year, bringing millions of dollars to that publication. And then salespeople go forth in medical doctors' offices proclaiming a brand new important drug. All of that is a fraud. It is a crime against humanity. And yet no one will be held accountable, and the FDA will be the last source to ever protect your interest. It is a shame. So understand, very, very realistically, during the past decade, scientific prejudice and bias and outright deceit are what we have been seeing in the peer review system. And in 2009, Harvard's Dr. Marcia Angell, a former editor for the prestigious New England Journal, wrote the following, quote, "It is simply no longer possible to believe much of the clinical research that is published or to rely on the judgment of trusted physicians or authorities in medical guidelines. I take no pleasure in this conclusion, which I reach slowly and reluctantly over my 2 decades as an editor," end quote. Later, the editor of The Lancet, Dr. Richard Horton, stated, quote, "The case against science is straightforward. Much of the scientific literature, perhaps half, may simply be untrue," end quote. A large percentage of published studies and trials have either not been reproduced or failed to be reproduced. For example, in 2012, a scientist and his team at Amgen attempted to reproduce 53 published cancer studies and only succeeded in reproducing 6. In another project published in Nature, only 39 of 100 psychology studies could be replicated. Although Dr. Horton is optimistic that the proverbial cat is out of the bag and the medical community has been warned, he despairs, quote, "The bad news is that nobody is ready to take the first step to clean up the system." I repeat this, quote, "Nobody is ready to take the first step to clean up the system," end quote. And that is from the editor-in-chief of one of the most important scientific publications in the world. Doctors at Children's Hospital Boston undertook the task of reviewing 546 drug trials listed in the government's clinical trials database. They found that industry-funded trials showing positive results were 70% more likely to be published than research funded by federal health agencies. In 2010, a multi-institutional review of studies for 12 antidepressant drugs that cumulatively enrolled over 12,500 patients was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. The group, representing researchers from Oregon Health and Science University, Harvard University, University of California, Riverside and others identified a deeply biased and deceptive trend in publication of these drugs' respective trials that was highly selective. 36 of the 37 favorable studies were published. On the other hand, only 3 of 36 unfavorable trials found their way into print. The consequences are obvious. By giving the false impression that over 90% of the studies confirmed the value of antidepressant drugs, while burying almost the same number of adverse trials, the entire risk-benefit ratio of these drugs is skewed. There is also the matter of private corporations reaching out to public relations firms and independent technical writers to ghostwrite articles on behalf of their research and commercial products, which first came to light about a decade ago. Now, despite growing awareness, the practice continues and, in fact, has become more common during the past several years. Ghostwriting has become a global cottage industry. Although ghostwriting is generally regarded as improper, it's not illegal. Parallel to the alarming revelations that scientific journals are publishing increasing amounts of junk science, there was the problem of scientific authors' personal bias due to their financial ties to private industry, and hence the very research and products they were positively writing about. For many decades, this was not considered a serious problem. But increasingly, authors would hide their financial conflicts of interest. Consequently, the most respected science journals require authors to reveal their associations and conflicts of interest with private companies and private for-profit industries and institutions that may compromise the objectivity of their articles. To get around this requirement, companies reach out to ghostwriters who can paint themselves as independent and conflict-free to submit favorable articles. I'm Gary Nall. This is part 2 of our series, Corruption of Science and the Fall of Civilization. Richard Gale and myself are the authors. It is on our website, prn.fm. Back in a moment with our guest. Please stand by. Welcome, all of you. We're going to speak now with Professor Joan Mellon. She is Professor Emeritus in Literature and Creative Writing at Temple University, where she has taught for 50 years. She received her university's highest honors over the years as a teacher and a Lifetime Achievement Award. Joan has authored over 24 books dealing with historical investigations that include Lyndon Johnson, the Texas robber baron culture, CIA activities in Cuba, the CIA's operations in Haiti, and the JFK assassination. Her most recent book is Blood in the Water, which investigates the joint U.S.-Israeli false flag operation to sink the USS Liberty in 1967. The renowned political science author Richard Falk at Princeton University has called Joan's work the definitive study about the event. Her website is joanmellon, M-E-L-L-E-N, .com. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. Nice to be here.
The United States is engaged in many false flags in its history, some successful, others like Operation Northwood, which never got underway. One that receives little attention, although there are plenty of unanswered questions, was the direct attack on the unarmed American spy and surveillance ship, the USS Liberty, on June 8, 1967, on the third day into the six-day war between Israel and Egypt. The attack was conducted by unmarked Israeli fighter jets, which was against international law And later, they used torpedo boats. The official story is that Israel admitted the attack and claimed the Liberty was mistaken for an Egyptian freighter. The end of the story, and that has been the case for over 50 years, and during every presidency was, it's a closed story, it's over, don't go any further. However, you have uncovered enormous amounts of information and documentation to show that this was a plan orchestrated by Lyndon Johnson, President of the United States, CIA head James Angleton, and Israel's Mossad from the get-go. So there are four main areas I would like you to touch upon. First, please, speak about the planning between the United States and Israel that led to the decision to launch the attack. And then, what was the motive, since the Liberty was ordered to only be spying on Egypt and Soviet activities? The forum is yours.
Hi, Gary. Well, I don't know where to start. I'll start with the planning, as you suggest, which was several months earlier. And the planning occurred within the 303 Committee, which was a committee of the executive branch of the U.S. government. And the idea was, again, as you say, to bomb a ship and to acute. The point was to point the guilt at Egypt. And then that would lead to the getting rid of Nasser, who was a great enemy of CIA counterintelligence chief James Angleton, Dulles, and so forth. But in order to do that, in order to say that Egypt did this terrible deed of killing all these unarmed Americans, in order to do that, you had to sink the ship and everyone on it had to die so that there were no witnesses. And what happened was that many of the sailors turned out to be veterans of World War II. They were very capable, and they kept the ship afloat, even though it was hit by a torpedo at one point and would surely have sunk, except that it didn't. And SOS went out to the Sixth Fleet, and at that point, Israel and the U.S. had to give up this operation. And at that point, when they gave it up, the Sixth Fleet had already sent planes to bomb Cairo. And we have evidence of that even in many ways in the book, but also the admiral of the Sixth Fleet, whose name was William Martin, he told some of the sailors, everybody was so appalled by this that he felt that he had to tell them that they were not abandoned. And so he sat down with some sailors on the USS Little Rock, which was his flagship, and he told them, "We didn't abandon you." And that they had the planes that he had sent off to bomb Cairo were 7 minutes from target when the operation was called off because the Liberty was not going to sink. So it's a horrendous story, a frightening story. And the people who were on the ship, many have survived to this day. Some died, I think 34 died. But many are alive, and they are very upset that there has never been an inquiry exposing what really happened. So I set out to do the impossible and to find out exactly who planned it, who was involved, how it was covered up, and so forth. So I did. I did the best I could. I think I established the collusion between the United States and Israel and the cover-up that went on right after the attack, and at which the sailors were warned if they ever talk about what happened and what they saw, they would be put in Leavenworth prison. They were all military people, and it was terrifying. Many of these sailors were very young; they were under 20 years old, and so they kept quiet until for a good many years. Until finally, one of them wrote a book just telling about the attack. But I felt that there was a lot that wasn't established: who did it, why did they do it, how was it done, and so forth. And so I set out with the help of the chief intelligence officer of the Liberty at the time, named Dave Lewis, and he helped me enormously to establish all of this. And I felt that I had, and he was the one who was told that Lyndon Johnson had intervened personally when the SOS had gone out to the Sixth Fleet, and the captain of the USS Saratoga was quite honest. He didn't even wait for anything. He just sent planes to the site of the Liberty, and when Johnson found out about it, they were called back. That happened three times, that the planes were sent, and then they were called back. I don't want to embarrass an ally, Johnson said. And unfortunately for them, there was witness, somebody who was listening, like and Dave was told by one of the admirals of the Sixth Fleet, whose name was Lawrence Geis, what happened. But he had to keep silent during Admiral Geis's lifetime. Well, he did. And then when Admiral Geis died, Dave talked about it. And then there was no doubt, because Dave was just about one of the most honest people in the U.S. military. Now, one book that was written by the son of one of the sailors still did not include the Johnson part of the story, even though he talked to Dave Lewis on numerous occasions. It was too much. So, you see, Johnson's biographers, it's a little footnote, have constantly covered up for Johnson on any number of issues and incidents, and this is going to be one of them. Margaret Carroll has not yet covered 1967. But in his next book, which is, I suppose, the last, he has to deal with it. And I just wonder what he'll do.
Just to be clear, once the USS Liberty was under attack, a local ship sent fighter planes to protect the unarmed vessel, American vessel. And Lyndon Johnson personally intervened in three separate times. So while he was keeping the USS Liberty from being protected by other Americans' aircraft, so Israel could go in and destroy the ship.
So Israel could cover up its complicity in this, because Israel did the attack. The actual attack, which occurred that afternoon of June 8th, those were all Israeli planes. Rockets, jets, the torpedo boats, all of that came from Israel. Israel was the actual one who did the attack.
Later, I think it's important.
The same day.
Joan, I think it's important for listeners to understand that this was an attack to the death. It was intended to sink the Liberty, as you mentioned, without any survivors. How did you come to that conclusion? And after the Sixth Fleet learned the Liberty did not sink, how and why did the original plans have to change?
They had to change because it didn't matter anymore. The ship was not going to sink, and they were going to be witnesses. And so they had to quickly cover it up. And the best way that Israel could do that was to say that they thought, as you said earlier, that they thought this was an Egyptian horse carrier, and they made a mistake. Now, why you would bomb a horse carrier to the death? I mean, because the bombing was nonstop. And the point was obviously to sink the ship. The last part of the torpedoes would surely sink the ship, except that one of the engineers on the Liberty had served in World War II and had survived Nazi torpedo attacks and knew how to do it, knew what to do, and knew how to keep right the ship that was about to capsize. And then there was no point, because it became clear that it was Israel. Clear to the world, clear to the world press, there's Israel hitting this American, unarmed, as you said, American ship, and to the death. It was to the death. Everybody that was on the ship saw that.
So it was all about Israel gaining a position in the Middle East, and the head of our own CIA or our other governmental agencies, maybe in the Defense Department, getting rid of Nasser, who they didn't like, as you mentioned earlier. I think it's important for listeners to get the perspective that the American leaders and the Israeli leaders are really the culprits because they planned and executed this false flag operation. But shouldn't we also indict the heads of other agencies like the National Security Agency and the CIA and the Defense Department, because they would have had to have known either before this happened or after it happened, and yet we've never heard a single one of those people come forward to say, here's what I know, as if no one knew anything. There's just this one incident out there in the middle of the ocean, and everyone else was kept in the dark. And I don't believe that everyone can be kept in the dark based upon how I understand our agency's work. Your thoughts?
Well, CIA station chief in Tel Aviv knew. He didn't say one single word till the time he died many years later, because it indicts the entire government and our government killed its own people for what? And to some people, it seems as if we did it for Israel, so that Israel could because what Israel did after this ended, after the Six-Day War ended, Israel immediately started those settlements that are still a problem today. And then they increased their land by twice as much. So they had a lot to gain by this. I don't know how to, and then when you study this, I studied in great detail. What you find is that these agencies are not monoliths. CIA, yes, James Angleton occupied what was called the Israel desk, and he was in charge of any operations involving Israel, yes. And he was very close with the head of the Mossad, whose name was Meir Amit, and I put his face on the back of the book jacket so you could see. Those are the two people that were involved that I put on the cover, Meir Amit, the head of the Mossad, and John Haddon, who was the CIA station chief in Tel Aviv and really didn't do anything. He knew, but he didn't do anything about it. Because to indict the, to really tell the truth, is to indict the entire U.S. government. And I don't know where you go from there. Because if they're killing their own people, how can you believe a word they say? How can you follow their orders? So this was really crucial that it be covered up. They saw that immediately. They saw that on the day of the attack, that it all had to be covered up. They threatened all the sailors, and they did what they could. Over the years, they had organizations like the Veterans of Foreign Wars and American Legion Post, some of them, to keep the lid on this story. Because how can you have faith in the U.S. government when it does something like this? It treats its people as expendable. And that's what the chief engineer who saved the ship, George Golden, his name was, he said, we were expendable. We were guinea pigs. Because you had to put the ship in that spot in order for it to be attacked, which, of course, means foreknowledge of both the United States government and the Israelis, and then wait till it happened.
You realize, Joan, that you're going to be attacked by the very powerful Israeli lobby. They have influence over every media. You won't be able to get on the major media. CNN, MSNBC, all the major networks are beholding first to Israel. You also realize the American Congress will do nothing with this because Bernie Sanders and other people pretend to actually be independent all signed a letter of allegiance to Israel that no matter what Israel does, we will defend it. You're also aware that it is Israel who is causing most of the conflict in the Middle East right now, aligning itself with Saudi Arabia, a terrorist state, and the United Arab Emirates. You also are aware that the French government, Macron's government, is corrupt, that British under May and before her, Cameron, are corrupt in allegiance with Israel. So I commend you for your courage and knowing that you're standing up against the most powerful forces in the world who not one second will they tolerate this. So you can expect an enormous blowback against blood in the water, how the U.S. and Israel conspired to ambush USS Liberty. Have you considered what the response will be and how you will handle it?
Gary, that's a very good point, and I don't know how I'll handle it except day to day. But I'm aware of all this because I wrote a book earlier called The Farewell to Justice about the Kennedy assassination and the Garrison investigation in New Orleans. And CIA mobilized its forces to destroy Garrison, to criticize him, destroy him, and they succeeded. And they had the media forces, and to this day, anything that praises Garrison will get attacked. I will not get reviewed in the New York Times. I've already known that from A Farewell to Justice. I expect that. I didn't expect media on television. You can't even hear the name Garrison on any of these cable TV stations. They're totally co-opted. And it's very funny that you should say about Bernie Sanders, because Dave Lewis, whom I mentioned earlier, his book is dedicated to, all the sailors of the Liberty called their senators and congresspeople to try to get some attention to the issue. Well, Dave lived in Vermont at the time. He calls up his senator. That's Bernie Sanders. And Sanders comes to the phone, and he says, I'm sorry, but this is unacceptable. It's impossible. It's not appropriate. So then Dave said, well, I have a friend who's a rabbi, and maybe he can be the intermediary for your views. No, that's not appropriate either, and Sanders hangs up. So there's a direct contact with Bernie Sanders. If you're guessing, you're right. He's determined. It's just taboo. The only person of my knowledge that stood up at the time was a congressman from Louisiana called John Rarick, who was a classmate of Garrison's. I knew him that way, and he was a source on my Garrison book. And he stood up and said, what's going on here? This is impossible. It couldn't have happened this way. But he was He was a segregationist. He was, but on this issue, he was honest. Very, there were very few honest people out there. What can
well,
I
in the media, in the media, you're not going to find that. However, there's a lot within alternative media, Truth Dig, Consortium News, Global Research would be a good place. If you don't know the people, Global Research, Richard Gale does, and we'll try to get your book and you reviewed as many places as possible. We're out of time, but thank you very much, Joan, for your courage and your scholarship.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
That's Professor Joan Mellon, Professor Emeritus, and she has authored many books. She has never been found wrong on any of her facts down at Temple University for 50 years. And what courage it takes. And that is terrific that she has done this. So now you know the truth. The media will not touch it. You will not hear this discussed on any of these other radio programs because that's the control they have. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all for listening. And we'll have another interesting program for you on Monday. Have a good day, everyone. The boogie down, down the phone, the boogie down.